Chapter 6. The cars that made up the presidential motorcade were lined in a row beside the south portico of the White House. As soon as the Secret Service detail was in position, Oscar Lucas spoke into a tiny microphone whose wire looped around the watch on his wrist and ran up the sleeve of his coat. "Tell the boss we're ready." 3 minutes later, the president, accompanied by Fawcett, walked briskly down the steps and entered the presidential limousine. Lucas joined them, and the cars moved out through the southwest gate. The president relaxed into the leather of the rear seat and idly stared out the window at the passing buildings. Fawcett sat with an open attaché case on his lap and made a series of notes inside the top folder. After a few minutes of silence, he sighed, snapped the case shut, and set it on the floor. "There it is, arguments from both sides of the fence, statistics, CIA projections, and the latest reports from your Economic Council on communist bloc debts. Everything you should need to sell Larimer and Moran on your way of thinking."
"The American public doesn't think much of my plan, does it?" the president asked quietly.
"To be perfectly honest, no, sir," Fawcett replied. "The general feeling is to let the Reds stew in their own problems. Most Americans are cheering the fact that the Soviets and their satellites are facing starvation and financial ruin. They consider it proof positive that the Marxist system is a pathetic joke."
"It won't be a joke if the Kremlin leaders, backs against an economic wall, strike out in desperation and march through Europe."
"Your opposition in Congress feel the risk is offset by the very real threat of starvation, which will undermine Russia's capacity to maintain its military machine. And there are those who are banking on the eroding morale of the Russian people to crystallize an active resistance toward the ruling party."
The president shook his head. "The Kremlin is fanatical about its military buildup. They'll never slack off in spite of their economic dilemma. And the people will never rise up or stage mass demonstrations. The party's collar is too tight."
"The bottom line," said Fawcett, "is that both Larimer and Moran are dead set against taking the burden off Moscow."
The president's face twisted in disgust.
"Larimer is a drunk, and Moran is tainted with corruption. Still, there is no getting around the fact you have to sell them on your philosophy."
"I can't deny their opinions," the president admitted, "but I am convinced that if the United States saves the Eastern Bloc nations from almost total disintegration, they will turn away from the Soviet Union and join with the West."
"There are many who see that as wishful thinking, Mr. President. The French and Germans see it my way."
"Sure, and why not?
They're playing both ends of the field, relying on our NATO forces for security while expanding economic ties with the East. You're forgetting the many grassroots American voters who are behind my aid plan, too," said the president, his chin thrust forward at his words. "Even they realize its potential for defusing the threat of nuclear holocaust and pulling down the Iron Curtain for good." Fawcett knew it was senseless to try to sway the president when he was in a crusading mood and passionately convinced he was right. There was a kind of virtue in killing your enemies with kindness, a truly civilized tactic that might move the conscience of reasonable people. But Fawcett remained pessimistic. He turned inward to his thoughts and remained silent as the limousine turned off M Street into the Washington Naval Yard and rolled to a stop on one of the long docks. A dark-skinned man with the stony facial features of an American Indian approached as Lucas stepped from the car.
"Evening, George."
"Hello, Oscar. How's the golf game?"
"Sad shape," answered Lucas. "I haven't played in almost 2 weeks."
As Lucas spoke, he looked into the piercing dark eyes of George Black Owl, the acting supervisor and advance agent for the president's movement. Black Owl was about Lucas' height, 5 years younger, and carried about 10 pounds of excess weight. A habitual gum chewer, his jaws worked constantly, he was half Sioux and was constantly kidded about his ancestors' role at the Little Bighorn.
"Safe to board?" asked Lucas.
"The boat has been swept for explosives and listening devices. The frogmen finished checking the hull about 10 minutes ago, and the outboard chase boat is manned and ready to follow."
Lucas nodded.
"A 110-foot Coast Guard cutter will be standing by when you reach Mount Vernon."
"Then I guess we're ready for the boss."
Lucas paused for nearly a minute while he scanned the surrounding dock area. Detecting nothing suspicious, he opened the door for the president. Then the agents formed a security diamond around him. Black Owl walked ahead of the point man, who was directly in front of the president. Lucas, because he was left-handed and required ease of movement in case he had to draw his gun, walked the left point and slightly to the rear.
Fawcett tailed several yards behind and out of the way. At the boarding ramp, Lucas and Black Owl stood aside to let the others pass.
"Okay, George, he's all yours."
"Lucky you," Black Owl said, smiling. "You get the weekend off."
"First time this month."
"Heading home from here?"
"Not yet. I have to run by the office and clear my desk first. There were a few hitches during the last trip to Los Angeles. I want to review the planning."
They turned in unison as another government limousine pulled up to the dock. Senator Marcus Larimer climbed out and strode toward the presidential yacht, followed by an aide who dutifully carried an overnight bag. Larimer wore a brown suit with a vest. He always wore a brown suit with a vest. It had been suggested by one of his fellow legislators that he was born in one. His hair was sandy-colored and styled in the dry look. He was big and rough-cut, with the look of a hod carrier trying to crash a celebrity benefit. He simply nodded to Black Owl and threw Lucas the standard politician's greeting.
"Nice to see you, Oscar."
"You're looking healthy, Senator."
"Nothing a bottle of scotch won't cure," Larimer replied with a booming laugh.
Then he swept up the ramp and disappeared into the main salon.
"Have fun," Lucas said sarcastically to Black Owl. "I don't envy you this trip."
A few minutes later, while driving through the Naval Yard gate onto M Street, Lucas passed a compact Chevrolet carrying Congressman Alan Moran going in the opposite direction. Lucas didn't like the Speaker of the House. Not nearly as flamboyant as his predecessor, Moran was a Horatio Alger type who had succeeded not so much from intelligence or perception as from stowing away in the congressional power circles and supplying more favors than he begged. Once accused of masterminding an oil leasing scheme on government lands, he had greased his way out of the impending scandal by calling in his political IOUs. He looked neither right nor left as he drove by. His mind, Lucas deduced, was grinding on ways to pick the president's influential pocket. Not quite an hour later, as the crew of the presidential yacht were preparing to cast off, Vice President Margolin came aboard with a garment bag draped over one shoulder. He hesitated a moment and then spied the president, seated alone in a deck chair near the stern, watching the sun begin to set over the city. A steward appeared and relieved Margolin of the garment bag. The president looked up and stared as though not fully recognizing him.
"Vince?"
"Sorry I'm late," Margolin apologized, "but one of my aides misplaced your invitation and I only discovered it an hour ago."
"I wasn't sure you could make it," the president murmured obscurely.
"Perfect timing. Beth is visiting our son at Stanford and won't be home until Tuesday, and I had nothing on my schedule that couldn't be shoved ahead." The president stood up, forcing a friendly smile. "Senator Larimer and Congressman Moran are on board, too. They're in the dining salon." He tilted his head in their direction. "Why don't you say hello and rustle up a drink?"
"A drink I could use."
Margolin bumped into Fawcett in the doorway, and they exchanged a few words. The president's face was a study in anger. As much as he and Margolin differed in style and appearance, the vice president was tall and nicely proportioned, not a bit of fat on his body, with a handsome face, bright blue eyes, and a warm, outgoing personality. They differed even more in their politics. The president maintained a high level of personal popularity by his inspirational speeches. An idealist and a visionary, he was almost totally occupied with creating programs that would be of global benefit 10 to 50 years in the future. Unfortunately, for the most part, they were programs that did not fit in with the selfish realities of domestic politics. Margolin, on the other hand, kept a low profile with the public and news media, aiming his energies toward more domestic issues. His stand on the president's communist bloc aid program was that the money could be better spent at home. The vice president was a born politician. He had the Constitution in his blood. He had come up the hard way, through the ranks, beginning with his state legislature, then governor, and later the Senate. Once entrenched in his office in the Russell Building, he surrounded himself with a powerhouse staff of advisors who possessed a flair for strategic compromise and innovative political concepts. While it was the president who proposed legislation, it was Margolin who orchestrated its passage through the maze of committees into law and policy, all too often making the White House staff appear like fumbling amateurs, a situation that did not sit well with the president and caused considerable internal backstabbing.
Margolin might have been the people's choice for the presidency, but he was not the party's. Here his integrity and image as a shaker and doer worked against him. He too often refused to fall in line on partisan issues if he believed in a better path. He was a maverick who followed his own conscience. The president watched Margolin disappear into the main salon, irritation and jealousy burning within him.
"What is Vince doing here?" Fawcett asked him nervously.
"Damned if I know," snapped the president. "He said he was invited." Fawcett looked stricken. "Christ, somebody on the staff must have screwed up." "Too late now. I can't tell him he's not wanted and to please leave." Fawcett was still confused. "I don't understand."
"Neither do I, but we're stuck with him."
"He could blow it."
"I don't think so. Regardless of what we think about Vince, he's never made a statement that tarnished my image. That's more than a lot of presidents could say about their VPs."
Fawcett resigned himself to the situation.
"There aren't enough staterooms to go around. I'll give up mine and stay on shore."
"I appreciate that, Dan. I can stay on the boat until tonight and then bunk at a nearby motel."
"Perhaps, under the circumstances," the president said slowly, "it would be best if you remained behind. With Vince along, I don't want our guests to think we're ganging up on them."
"I'll leave the documents supporting your position in your stateroom, Mr. President."
"Thank you. I'll study them before dinner."
Then the president paused.
"By the way, any word on the Alaskan situation?"
"Only that the search for the nerve agent is underway." The president's eyes reflected a disturbed look. He nodded and shook Fawcett's hand. "See you tomorrow." Later, Fawcett stood on the dock among the irritated Secret Service agents of the vice president's detail. As he watched the aging white yacht cut into the Anacostia River before turning south toward the Potomac, a knot began to tighten in the pit of his stomach. There had been no written invitations. None of it made any sense. Lucas was putting on his coat, about to leave his office, when the phone linked to the command post buzzed.
"Lucas?"
"This is Loveboat," replied George Black Owl, giving the code name of the movement in progress. The call was unexpected, and like a father with a daughter on a date, Lucas immediately feared the worst.
"Go ahead," he said tersely.
"We have a situation. This is no emergency, I repeat, no emergency. But something's come up that isn't in the movement." Lucas expelled a sigh of relief.
"I'm listening."
"Shakespeare is on the boat," said Black Owl, giving the code name for the vice president.
"He's where?"
Lucas gasped. "Margolin showed up out of nowhere and came on board as we were casting off. Dan Fawcett gave him his stateroom and went ashore. When I queried the president about the last-minute switch in passengers, he told me to let it ride. But I smell a screw-up."
"Where's Reinman?"
"Right here with me on the yacht."
"Put him on."
There was a pause, and then Hank Reinman, the supervisor in charge of the vice president's security detail, came on.
"Oscar, we've got an unscheduled movement."
"Understood. How did you lose him?"
"He came charging out of his office and said he had to attend an urgent meeting with the president on the yacht. He didn't tell me it was an overnight affair."
"He kept it from you?"
"Shakespeare is tight-mouthed as hell. I should have known when I saw the garment bag. I'm sorry as hell, Oscar."
A wave of frustration swept Lucas. God, he thought, the leaders of the world's leading superpowers were like kids when it came to their own security.
"It's happened," said Lucas sharply, "so we'll make the best of it. Where is your detail?"
"Standing on the dock," answered Reinman.
"Send them down to Mount Vernon and back up Black Owl's people. I want that yacht cordoned off tighter than a bass drum."
"Will do."
"At the slightest hint of trouble, call me. I'm spending the night at the command post."
"You got a line on something?" Reinman asked.
"Nothing tangible," Lucas replied, his voice so hollow it seemed to come from a distant source. "But knowing that the president and the next three men in line for his office are all in the same place at the same time scares the hell out of me."